Ray Columbus, featuring the Art Collection. Ray Columbus died on this day 5 years ago. He was, of course, the lead vocalist of the Invaders. They had a huge hit with their cover of the Senators' song, She's a Mod. Less well known, perhaps, is Ray Columbus's time in California from 1966 to 68, where he had a band called Ray Columbus and the Art Collection. And this song here, Columbus pitched to Kellogg's, the cornflake conglomerate, turned it down as they had already signed the Monkees to perform their jingles. And for a while, the Art Collection were Sonny and Cher's backing band. And while he was stateside, Ray Columbus was offered an audition with the Monkees, but turned it down. He also turned down the chance to play with David Crosby or Gene Clark after these musicians left the Byrds. So some interesting New Zealand pop history there. And I'd never heard, Ella Henry, of the Art Collection featuring Ray Columbus. Had you heard of that era? We all hear of She's a Mod, but not so much this psychedelic era when he was in California.
No, I think that's wonderful news. But I did used to listen to Ray Columbus and the Invaders. I started going to nightclubs in 1970, which I just realised was 50 years ago. And there was a very lively music scene in Auckland at the time with some fabulous groups of which his was part of. So it's lovely to hear that, you know, the music is still being enjoyed.
Wow. So you saw him live?
Yeah, but, oh, well, I mean, it wasn't hard to do. There were only three clubs in Auckland in 1972.
Fantastic, fantastic. It is 25 to 5, the panel, RNZ National. Just recapping the news today from the Post Cabot 4. On Friday, the country will move into the traffic light system. Traffic light system, it's a new tool to restrict the spread of COVID-19. So with Northland, Auckland, Taupo and Rotorua Lakes districts, Kawerau, Whakatane, Porirangi districts, Gisborne, Wairua, Rangitike, Whanganui and Ruapehu districts, they're going to be in the red setting. The rest of the North Island and the South Island will begin in orange. The setting's in place for 2 weeks and Cabinet will review the traffic light settings on Monday, December the 13th. Now, also, business-wise, a new transition payment of up to $24,000 will soon be available for businesses, particularly those in Auckland, Waikato and Northland, and it'll be available on December the 10th. Now, as I said, last week we discussed ageism in getting a job for those in their 50s and above. Now to ageism at the other end. The youngest person ever elected to the Bay of Plenty Regional Council has decided not to stand for re-election after experiencing ageism and abuse. Stacey Rose, 22, a barber-turned-councillor, joined the Bay of Plenty Regional Council 3 years ago at the age of 19 and says he was made to feel that, as a young person, he had no right to be involved in decision-making. So why is he leaving local politics? Stacey Rose, Ngāi Tahu, Ngāti Mamoe, Waitaha, the Bay of Plenty Regional Councillor, Stacey Tinakwe, welcome to the panel.
Tēnā koutou, Wallace. Kei te piākwe.
Lovely to have you on the panel. Very well, thank you, Stacey. Now, what kind of abuse have you been experiencing, or had you been experiencing?
Yeah, so in regards to the abuse and the commentary that was given to me whilst in council, I've experienced comments such as, you're not good enough for this role, you're too young, you should resign as you are not worthy of this position. And I've even had other councillors make comments in regards to my age and trying to do certain roles in council.
So was it just the fact that you wanted to get into politics or wanted to get local council and very excited about this, and this whole experience, Stacey, just demoralised you, in fact, demoralised you so much that you're leaving?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
So what's the solution? What's the outcome here? Is this ageism? Is it ageism that is keeping young people from entering or engaging with politics, do you think?
I think for local body politics, I can't speak for central government politics, but local body, the key issue is around age and the fact that young people, one, don't understand what local government does, and two, the fact that when it comes to voting and when it comes to actually looking at who's standing. You look at the list and most of them are old white people. And you don't get many Māori or Pacifica or Asian or European people running. And you don't get many young people running either because, one, they don't understand it, and, two, they're scared about the backlash that's going to come through and bite them in the ass.
We'll come to our panel. We've got a panel with us, Stacey, but Stuart Crosby, you know, from local government NZ, he's been quite a backer of you, and he was saying, Stuart was saying that you were single-handedly responsible for strengthening relationships with rangatahi, local rangatahi. So that's a pretty awesome affirmation, Stacey.
Yes, yes. When it comes to my fellow councillors, I have had real good support from some of my fellow councillors, and Stuart is one of those. Stuart is one of the Tauranga councillors alongside myself. And actually, I have had real good support from some of my fellow councillors. However, some of my fellow councillors outside of that support group have actually been very detrimental and have actually been pushes against getting our rangatahi and our local young people involved in local body politics.
All right, let's bring our panel in. Ella, you got a thought or a comment for Stacey here?
Well, first and foremost, kia kaha to you, Stacey. I just am so proud of young people who take their civil obligations as seriously as you have. And I'd also like to add that cultures that do not value their young are, quite frankly, doomed. Because you are the face of the future. And to have young folk engaged at that political and civil level is a sign of a healthy society. The fact that you happen to live in a part of the country that does not support you, I think is an absolute indictment of that part of the country. And let's be clear, Tauranga councils have been accused of many odious things in recent years, whether it's been a lack of consultation or, you know, racism and now ageism. I think that the people of that community need to take that in stock when they go to the elections next. So kia kaha to you, my dear.
Kia ora.
And picking up on that, Stacey, you have you described yourself as quote unquote a white passing Māori. Have you faced racism as well as ageism?
I wouldn't say I've faced racism in my council. Yes, comments have been made, and I guess that is just the way of the past. And they haven't really been aimed at me. We're very lucky at the Regional Council in the Bay of Plenty to have Māori seats, and we were the first to have them. So a lot of the flack that is received mainly hits them. However, I have experienced being obviously young, but also being Māori, some criticism in and around decisions that we make, mainly because of the fact that I'm Māori in a general seat.
Right. Here's a text here. Wallace, we have a 22-year-old Heather G. Taylor in Manawatū doing a great job. All right, Phil Taylor, your thoughts on this? Comments, questions?
Kia ora, Stacey. And first of all, thanks so much for putting your hand up for this role in the past, and appreciate people who put themselves forward for public life and know how difficult that must be. And but someone's got to do it, and you sound like an intelligent, articulate person, and I'm sure you've made a very valuable contribution in your time, and I would encourage you to, once you've stepped back a bit, dust yourself off, had another look at what you want to contribute in your life, maybe stand up again for public office sometime in the future.
Is that a possibility, Stacey?
It would be a possibility, potentially. However, I would need to take some time to collect myself and really just focus on myself for a bit.
Kia ora, Stacey. Thanks for being with us this afternoon, and all the very best for the future. I really appreciate you on the panel here. That is Stacey Rose, a Bay of Plenty Regional Council. Can't be easy, Ella Henry, being 19 years old, you know, on your local council, because local councils, you know, local body politics, they can be, you know, pretty tough at the best of times. We've seen a lot of issues around the country, haven't we, with local council?
They're an interesting thing, local councils in this country. It may be different in others, but I've certainly looked at them in the past and found that they do tend to be bastions of middle-aged, middle-class, white privilege and overwhelmingly male-dominated. So I do think that young folk standing up to represent their community, and there are a growing number of them. Look at, you know, Chloe Swarbrick's in National Parliament now started out, in local politics.
Right, yes.
I believe so. So I'm heartened that there is this group of young New Zealanders who want to put themselves up there, who are brave enough to, cope with the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that are going to be slung at them. And I think that bodes well for our future as a nation.
Yeah, another person here says, tell the guy to hang in there, don't give up, we need him. Is that fair comment, Phil, that actually we do, you know, he represents a kind of diversity that, you know, we do need 19-year-olds and we do need 65-year-olds.
Yeah, absolutely. And we do actually need more people putting their hand up for public office. And I was watching West Wing with the family, which is my repository go-to place for all political education. And there was a quote last night, which was public office is about democratically electing someone to take the blame for things. So it's a tough job. And I think we've got to take our hats off to people that do it and show them some respect.
Here on the panel, NZ National. Nice to have your company this afternoon. Ella Henry and Phil Taylor with me today. To this, a new study has found there's a lack of public transport access to healthcare in Ototahi, Christchurch. Some lower income residents are more than half an hour's bus ride away from their nearest medical centre, according to the study published in the New Zealand Medical Journal. This week with us now to discuss is lead author of the study, University of Otago Christchurch medical student Molly Hartley. Molly, welcome to the program.
Kia ora, thank you.
Pleasure to have you on, Molly. Now, how did you get to studying this aspect in the first place, the intersection between transport and medicine, or healthcare, rather?
I've always been really interested in public health and looking at how people can access healthcare and how a lack of access can sort of worsen health inequities that we're already struggling with. And so I was really interested in looking into whether the public transport system would be adequate for getting people to their healthcare appointments.
So what did you find? What are a couple of things that you uncovered?
Well, sort of overall, across the whole city, access to GPs using the bus network is pretty poor. And we also found that in the eastern suburbs, which are the lower socioeconomic ones, that access is poorer.
So why would that be? Tell us a bit about that. Why would that be?
Well, since the study came out, I've actually heard from a local councillor from that area who's told me that in recent years the bus routes have been cut down.
Right.
And it's created a bit of a problem, which I didn't even know about when I did this research.
Okay, so you compare it to urban England, where you say that 99% of the population could reach a GP on public transport in under 30 minutes. Is that kind of a standard? Is that where we need to be, that if you want to go to your local GP, the fact of the matter is that you need to get there, and if you haven't got a car or you can't go by car, you need to be able to get there on public transport in a reasonable amount of time. Is that the crux of it?
I mean, that would be amazing if that could be the case.
Mm. Ella, what do you think about this?
Well, I was part of the Building Challenge research a few years ago, and one of the National Science Challenges came up with the ideas of building community cohesion and how important walkability was to the communities of the future. I think this research is actually a blistering indictment on policy that allows this situation to occur, and why these factors have not been taken into consideration by the very highly paid officials who make decisions about public and transit systems and access and equity. Why is it, are we relying on a young university student to tell us stuff that should have been part of the planning process years ago? It's just shocking. I'm actually appalled.
Molly?
I mean, that reaction really gladdens me. It's really awesome that, you know, people are interested in the research. Yeah, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Molly, just turn your head just a little bit because you're really breaking up. We want to keep you here, but you're breaking up on us. But let me ask you, is it just due to the, and you, Ella, as well, is it the sheer logistics and complexity of trying to combine public transport with getting to your local GP? I mean, it would be hard to plan for, wouldn't it, in terms of a traffic exercise?
Can I just say that there is data, this mesh data for the whole country that has socioeconomic variables factored into it, and as there has been for decades now, which is supposed to inform decision-making about government policy, which filters down to transport and infrastructure and housing and roading. That data is there. I fail to see how it has been missed in such an important area as this.
Molly, do you think it's been missed?
I think that there were definitely gaps, you know, when I was reading up on this project to see if studies like this had been done before. One had been done in Auckland, but there had never been a study done in Christchurch looking at healthcare access using public transport.
Yeah. Phil, what do you think? What's your take on this?
Yeah, I think great work, Molly. I think that this is also probably one of the reasons why our vaccine rollout inequities has arisen. And I think one of the really interesting things to me is how actually going to the people, rather than sitting in the medical centre and waiting for the people to come to you, but actually having medical visits under socioeconomic areas may be part of the solution in the future as well.
So what do you think needs to be done, Molly? Is there a solution as part of all this?
Well, I love the idea of healthcare workers being able to go out into the community to people, to where the need is. But I think the solution sort of needs to come from both ends, you know, both from the transport system, but also from the healthcare infrastructure and where we decide to put our services. I think we need to be a bit more strategic about it and plan these things relative to need.
Well, all the best, Molly, and kia ora for that really interesting research. That is Molly Hartley of the University of Otago, Christchurch medical student, and it was just published in the New Zealand Medical Journal this week, finding there's a lack of public transport access to healthcare in Christchurch. But, you know, Ella, you couldn't get more inequity, could you? The fact that some people can get to their local GP better than others. But let me ask you this. I seem to recall, and listeners, help me out on this. Was there a day when your local GP would actually do more health visits, Ella?
Oh, yes, but I'm old enough to remember that. That stopped about 30 years ago.
Right.
And it stopped at a time when the population started to grow exponentially and the population of, you know, the ageing of GPs occurred and the introduction of student fees, which, I mean, to become a doctor costs you $150,000, you know. So there's all these other things going on that I think Jim Bolger talked about earlier in the week. We have a crisis of capitalism that we have to look at if we want to be a fair and sustainable society.
Phil, can you recall the local GP health visit?
Yeah, my father was a GP and used to do that. And,
did he?
Certainly not the case now. As you say, the medical centres are becoming very big, very sort of semi-industrialised by necessity because of the volume that they're required to do.
7 to 5, the panel, RNZ National. Lovely to have your company this afternoon. Now to this, finally, yes, that warmer weather is upon us, and while we humans can manage the rising temperature with aircon or an ocean swim, pets left alone in cars cannot. Ziff, this month the SPCA has received a surge in calls to rescue dogs left unattended in hot cars, including a five-month-old puppy. You risk an instant $300 fine if an animal in your car is found to have heat stress, and you'll have to pay to fix any smashed windows too. Here to spread the awareness, I'm joined by the SPCA's Inspectorate Team Leader for the wider Wellington region, Ben Lacombe. Ben, kia ora.
Kia ora, Wallace. How are you?
I'm really, really well. First, tell us about this five-month-old puppy. How was he when your team found him?
Yeah, so it was one of those ones where you turn up and your heart sinks a little bit because, you know, the little dog is panting heavily and it was looking at the windows really, really wanting to get out of the warm car. So our team member was able to engage the AA, who are really good at helping us out in those situations, and were able to get the puppy out. He was okay, but he needed to get out of that environment. So the owner has been educated with regards to dogs and cars, and hopefully we don't see a repeat of that one.
Yeah, good. It's good to hear the little puppy's okay. And in terms of education, or is it? Is it lack of awareness about the issue? Is it just that people forget to keep their window open slightly? Is it, or what is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think, you know, we all drive around, or most of us drive around in vehicles with air conditioning and are fairly comfortable when we get out of our vehicle. I think the main issue is we don't realise how quickly the temperatures can rise inside of a parked vehicle. So even with the windows down on a sort of 20-degree day, 21-degree day, the temperature can rise quite rapidly in just 10 minutes, right up to sort of 30 degrees.
Up to 30 degrees?
Yeah, that's right. And then if they're there for 30 minutes, we can be reaching temperatures of 40 degrees.
Oh, goodness gracious.
So dogs are only able to sustain a body temperature of sort of 41 degrees for a very short time before they start to suffer some real damage. So I think it's a little bit of a lack of awareness and just not thinking things through. You just really cannot leave your dog unattended in a car.
Phil Taylor.
Yeah, it's sad, isn't it? It's almost like people need a license in order to be allowed to look after a pet. And I really do hope that people take the right precautions in ensuring that their pets are looked after over the summer break.
Absolutely. Ella?
Well, I think I may be becoming a bit of a curmudgeon, but I'm beginning to believe that you can legislate for morality, and perhaps we need more stringent fines than, or sanctions than a gently worded re-education program for people who behave like that.
What do you reckon, Ben?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. We get a there's different severities, isn't there, of dogs and vehicles. You know, we get well-meaning members of the public ringing with absolutely no issue because the person's literally popped into a shop for 2 minutes. It was a well-intentioned call, but there wasn't an offence there as such. That's where we might provide some education. I see, you know, you're talking about the five-month-old puppy being owner being educated. Each case is assessed on its merits for what action is taken. But where appropriate, we definitely do issue those fines. And it can end up being a prosecution under the Animal Welfare Act as well, or the regulations if the situation requires it. It is a case-by-case approach, but we want to ensure that the animals are okay.
And Ben, I guess just a reminder that hot car mightn't be quite as hot to you, but if you're a little dog or a dog that is in that car for half an hour and over, that 20-degree inside might go up to 30 degrees. It might go up to 40 degrees.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And, you know, we do get people saying, well, I can sit in the car quite comfortably, but that's because we're not dogs. So, you know, dogs regulate their temperature differently. They struggle to do it as well as we do. So to be safe, if you can't take your dog with you when you're going, best to leave them at home.
Kia ora, Ben. Thanks for being with us. That is the SPCA's Ben Lacombe and Dr. Ella Henry and Phil Taylor. Kia ora to you both. Thanks so much for being with me this afternoon. Appreciate it. I'm Wallace Chapman. I'm back tomorrow, 3:45 sharp. Stay with us for Lisa Owen and Checkpoint.